LinkedIn presents.
Yo, what's going on, everybody? I am Vinny Potestivo. You are listening to I Have a Podcast, or watching I Have a Podcast Live. And we are about to meet a very special guest, Ryan Dusick. Ryan, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Vinny. It's great to be on your show.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in music and what opened up opportunities for you?
Yeah, well, you know, I started playing music when I was about 12 years old. My older brother was playing the guitar, and I was really inspired by his band and the school band that he was playing in, and I just wanted to be a part of it. So I begged my parents for a drum set, and I told them, you know, the drums are inside of me the same way that the guitar was inside of Josh. And before you knew it, I was playing in my brother's band, and I was playing in the school band, and, you know, we were playing around town. Like, my brother's band, we played at the Whiskey at Go-Go and the Troubadour and the Roxy here in Hollywood. And so by the time I was 14, 15, I was, you know, playing on the Sunset Strip. And then I started my own band when I was 16, when all of my brother and all of his friends went off to college. I just happened to be friends with this kid named Adam Levine, who was 14 at the time. And I was like the big brother, I guess, sort of organizing the whole thing. And I had the vision.
Yeah.
And I was along with the car too. So I was kind of carting everything
organizer.
Around. Yes. And my personality sort of lent itself to being the type A control freak who wanted to, organize and book shows and do the mailing lists and all that stuff.
So what is that like as a teenager?
Well, we started the band in 1994, so I'm kind of dating myself a little bit. And it took us about a decade to get to the point where people, you know the band as Maroon 5 and where we got to. So, you know, there was a lot of time to get used to what the world of the music industry was going to be for us. And the world changed a lot in that time, because when we first started, and we had one record deal in 96, 97. With Warner Brothers, that this was the old world. It was just, they spent a ton of money. They put out a record that they spent a lot of money on, and it just flopped and they dropped us. So that was over very quickly. And we had to learn about failure, and we had to learn about how to, you know, really be the caretakers of our own brand, you know? And so the second time around, when we did rename the band Maroon 5 and got our second record deal, now it was the early aughts, and we made the album Songs About Jane, and it was a different world. It was the digital age, and we were out on the road for a few years, really, before the album really blew up. And we had some time to get used to what it was going to be, but certainly nothing can really prepare you for going from the garage to, you know, Saturday Night Live and the Grammys.
Yeah,
and stuff.
like stadiums and where you went. So, where are you looking? What source are you pulling from? Where are you getting guidance? What's helping you process this?
Well, we were fortunate. We had great families that were really supportive, and we did have access to some good representation along the way to give us good advice. And we were pretty well protected. My dad's an attorney, so that helped me in terms of understanding the ins and outs of, you know, the contracts we were signing and everything we were getting into. I suppose there are pros and cons to everything, though, because in some ways, if you're sort of sheltered in that way, you can be a little bit spoiled, you know,
sure.
But at the same time, it is helpful to have people that are looking out for your best interest.
Well, how do you get a deal in music? Actually, I understand how you get a deal in music. How do you get a second deal? That's almost more difficult to me, it sounds like, than the first one.
Yeah. Well, you know, the answer today would probably be different than it was then. But for us, you know, we were so young when we got our first deal, and we were very precocious kids. I think there was a lot of natural talent, but not a lot of experience or any real, you know, idea of how to do it right. And the timing just wasn't right on the first record. But we were still, you know, barely in our 20s when we had one failed record deal underneath our belts. So the second time around, I'll tell you honestly, what it took was taking that natural talent and that natural chemistry that we had as a four piece and then a five piece, and doing a lot of hard work to develop that into what was our own unique sound. And that required us to push ourselves to not be satisfied was something that did work at first. We obviously got a lot of attention from our first song, batch of songs and our sound and everything that we developed. But we knew that from the failure of that record that we had a lot further to go. So we were trying out every style, every genre, every way that we could be inspired, and thinking to ourselves, look, if this song is good, then the next one is going to be better. And we did that over the course of the next like 5 years. And so we really discovered something that was really unique to us and that was timely. That was part of what was going on in music at the time, but it didn't really fit into any genre of, in terms of like, we got this feedback from every record label at the time around 2001, when we were showcasing those songs. They all told us, you got to pick a lane. You know, you got to be either an R&B band or a pop band or a rock band. We can't tell what you are because you're a little bit of all of those things. And we said, well, that's what makes us unique. So that's what's going to make us great. Not just, we could have a hit in one of those genres, but what's going to give us staying power is if we have our own genre. So we were really stuck to our guns in that way. And we really chose people to work with that saw that vision, you know, young people that were really motivated to, they had as much to prove as we did at that point. So our manager, Jordan Feldstein, who was a friend of ours, he was my age, like 23 at the time. And he just really wanted to hustle and work for us. We had an independent label that was just three guys basically in one office, just trying to build their label. And so it was just like, we were out there guerrilla warfare building this thing.
Yeah. Wow. Oftentimes your success hinges on how much the people around you want to see you be successful. And it sounds like you really surrounded yourself with some people who had beyond just your vested interest in mind. Talk to me a bit about the talent development process. How do you, especially as a young professional in an ensemble situation, how do you begin forming your self-ID and self-identification separate from the group?
Separate from the group. Well, you know, we were lucky. There was no pressure. There was no expectation when we first started the band. You know, I was 16 years old. And essentially for myself, I just wanted to make a lot of noise on the drums. And my inspirations in 1994 were the grunge scene of Seattle, you know, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and then bands like Rage Against the Machine and Tool. I was into heavy stuff. And so that was kind of how I saw myself as a musician, was kind of a dark and brooding heavy drummer. But then, you know, Adam and Jesse over the first couple of years of our band pretty quickly developed this knack for melody and harmony, which was beyond their years. And Adam just is kind of like a savant in that regard. And I recognized that there was probably a lot. I saw that there was talent there, and I saw that that was something I wanted to be a part of, and probably meant that I was going to have to shift my perception of myself a little bit. I wasn't going to be in the next Tool or Rage Against the Machine. We were going to do something that had potential to be, you know, maybe even more mainstream than that. And I also thought it would be silly to try to change essentially what Adam, as our frontman's, you know, essential talent was. He, you know, he was a good looking kid, charismatic, very pretty voice, and a knack for melody and harmony. It was like, it'd be silly not to pursue a sound and style that was consistent with what he was bringing and what the other talents of the different guys in the band were bringing. And we were very lucky to have a chemistry. We were all very different personalities, and had different tastes. Somehow it all came together in this sort of synergistic way. So I think then I started to define myself as just like one fourth of that, and then one fifth when we added James as an important cog in that machine. But, you know, basically I was the organized one. I was the one who was kind of the manager in the early days, and the one who tried to kick everyone's butt a little bit to keep us, you know, practicing and moving forward and booking more shows. And then in terms of the music itself, just trying to do something unique with the rhythm section, really focusing on arrangement as my forte in the music part. Because I knew I couldn't compete with Adam in terms of melody, and I couldn't compete with Jesse in terms of the harmonic arrangement stuff. But in terms of the rhythm section and how we built a track, I thought that was something that I could do something unique with.
Yeah, it's hard to land on something new. I feel like there's more of a focus on the message, the content, the storytelling. Meanwhile, like what you just said, was it was the storytellers. It was the four or five of us. It was our unique points of view that were so defined. To be honest, this seems like a lot of self-awareness for a 16-year-old, by the way.
Bruh. I was always an overthinker, you know, so yeah, probably
aware.
In terms of the pros and cons of that, certainly probably more self-awareness than your average 16 to 20-year-old in that stage of life. But at the same time, probably putting a lot of pressure on myself and making myself more stressed and anxious than I needed to be, even at that point where we were starting to have some attention from the industry.
Yeah.
Because essentially at the end of the day, when it comes down to the performance aspect, you just gotta try not to think too much and just go out and have a good time.
Yeah.
But that was always a difficult thing for me.
Flow being in it.
Yeah. I mean, drums were flow for me when it was in my garage and when it was, I mean, with the band, that was the most in flow I've ever felt in my life. But it wasn't until we were out on the road for a long period of time and promoting an album when it became, okay, now there's expectations beyond myself. There's expectations from my bandmates, from our management, from our record label, from, you know, the bigger you get, the more the expectations are sort of coming externally as much as they were coming from internally. So that made it harder for me to sit in my flow that I had felt naturally playing the drums with my buddy.
Yeah. Well, because you're aware, because there's this
awareness
piece of you that see, right. So how do you process it, and what ultimately helps you get to the point where you're healthy enough to begin this new phase of what you're doing in life professionally, even to give yourself the space and grace to do that?
Well, I had a really hard time. You know, it took over a matter of a few years promoting the album Songs About Jane. It went well for a couple of years, and then essentially I had a breakdown dealing with that intersection of the internal pressure I was putting on myself, meeting up with all the external pressures. And it really manifested in some physical ways that prevented me from being able to play the drums anymore. So that was devastating. And I had to deal with the loss of that identity, really, you know, as being the drummer in Maroon 5 and everything that I'd spent a decade building with those guys that was at the very core of my self-definition. And it took me a long time to get past that and to really find new meaning and purpose in my life. And I went through all the stages of grief dealing with that loss. And I was, you know, self-medicating and I was depressed and I was anxious. And it wasn't until I quit drinking and I started this journey of recovery in terms of overcoming some of the things that had challenged me in terms of my mental health, even beyond that I wasn't even aware of that had led to that breakdown, you know. And it was in the process of that I really found this new purpose and direction, because there was connection. There was a new connection in the process of recovery, which I had been lacking in my life since those days in the garage when it was just us in flow and doing that, having that purpose and direction there. And so I found a connection in the mental health area that was really inspiring and fulfilling to me. I was volunteering at a recovery center for a couple of years, early in recovery, in my own recovery, and just being, you know, peer support and co-leading groups. And that led to me going back to school to get a master's degree in clinical psychology to become a therapist. So I'm now an associate marriage and family therapist and life coach, which led to me writing a book about my whole story called Harder to Breathe.
Yeah.
Which is out now. And that has been another huge fulfilling thing in my life, another dream that I got to live. You know, I've had a dream of writing a book since I was a kid before the band. And I finally did it. And it has more purpose to it now because there's this element of being helpful, you know, putting something out into the world that could hopefully inspire some people. And it's started this whole new journey in my life now.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. And for coming back to creativity as a way to process the trauma, the drama, and the life events that, you know, just are naturally, inherently, fortunately and unfortunately in all of our lives. Do you find it difficult to show up?
No, at this point in my life, I have a much easier time showing up for things, I think, probably than I ever did in my life before. at the same time, even when you're in a really good place in your life, you have to be mindful of your limits. I'm a therapist and I talk about this with my clients every day, finding balance and recognizing that sometimes the best thing you can do for yourself is to give yourself a break. That's hard for me because I am a doer, you know, as somebody who I wake up and I just like a lot of us, I want to be productive. I'm thinking about what I want to accomplish and am I working towards my goals? But sometimes the most productive thing is to just rest. You know, you need your rest and then you come back and you're 10 times quicker and stronger and more focused on what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in the midst of really working hard, sometimes you walk right up to that line of burnout. And then you're not really helping anyone at most, you know, not even yourself, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know. There's a balance more this as I sort of enter midlife. I'm much more mindful of that than I was when I was younger.
What would you say is the message from Harder to Breathe, your memoir? What do you think is the message that's really been heard from the people who have read this so far?
Well, I think that essentially there's a message of self-compassion. Because, you know, what made my journey so difficult was that I was dealing with the loss of something that I had essentially been the source of my self-worth, you know? And so on top of dealing with loss, which is painful for anyone, you know, you have something significant in your life that you lose. I was literally adding insult to injury by beating myself up and telling myself I was a failure, you know, that I was defective in some way. And those things, that part of my psychology had contributed to the breakdown, you know, because I had been very perfectionistic, you know, very sort of put a lot of pressure on myself to do everything that I did to the highest degree. And so it added stress on top of a life that was inherently stressful. And then I had all those things that perfectionists often experience, like imposter syndrome, where you feel like, okay, do I really belong here? Am I just fooling everyone? And so the self-compassion element is so important, you know, being able to recognize, like, we all feel this way to a certain extent. Like, if you don't have to be perfect to be great, there's a difference between, you know, striving for excellence and being perfect, because perfection is an illusion, right? It doesn't exist. And then just hopefulness, you know, so more than anything else in terms of finding recovery and maintaining recovery and is being hopeful and finding somewhere in yourself the hope that things can get better, because I had sort of resigned myself to the idea that I had my shot at ultimate happiness and I had lost it. And so that, you know, the rest of my life was essentially going to be a disappointment. And it wasn't until I was able to find acceptance of that thing that I had lost and recognize that life had more to offer. And that when I'm, you know, 20 years out from that thing, there could be something else in my life that ultimately brings the same level, if not more level, of fulfillment and purpose in my life, which is exactly what I have found. And it was just letting go that allowed me to find it.
Wow.
I mean, I think also, you know, when we talk about purpose, which is, I think, very important to a fulfilling and contented life.
Purpose calling.
My purpose is calling. when we talk about purpose, I think a lot of times we think like it's something that we wake up one day and God or the universe just smacks us over the head with, like, here's your purpose. And some people, very few of us, are lucky enough to have that sense from an early age, like Adam did. You know, he just had this natural knack for music. And so that was probably his purpose pretty early on, was like, this is what I'm going to do with my life. And every now and then you find somebody with a special talent who has that, but most of us don't have. And the thing is that you don't need that to find purpose in life. Purpose is something that you can create for yourself. Just like meaning in life, you know, meaning can be fleeting. If you're as a sort of existentialist, I think meaning, you know, is the thing that has caused me the most anxiety in life, because it's like, what is the meaning of all this? But essentially, you know, we're meaning creating beings. You know, we're able to place meaning onto things, or to create things that give our lives meaning. And so when you have that mindset, and you recognize that when I wake up in the morning, whatever I invest myself in, whatever I make important to me, can be meaningful and purposeful, as long as I am really mindful of the process and the fact that this is for me and it's not for anyone else.
Wow. So to be meaningful and purposeful, moving forward as we're consuming content, maybe even creating our own content, what are some ways that we can, what are like the tools and strategies in place so that we can find flow?
Well, flow is such an important element, so much of psychology, and we talk about in the negative, you know, what's wrong with me and what do I need to fix?
Yep.
And positive psychology talks about flow, you know, as we think of happiness as just moments of joy. That's not essentially sustainable. Those moments of joy come, but they're fleeting. But flow is something that you can create. It's something that you can create more of in your life by investing yourself in things that give you a feeling of connectedness and purpose, right? And so, you know, whatever gives you that feeling, pursuing that more it feeds on itself. It creates more flow in your life. The more you invest in being mindful of being present and being connected to what you're doing one thing at a time and doing it well, the more flow kind of grows in your life. And for me also, it started with a kernel for me, you know, just of walking into recovery and recognizing that service for me was the thing that gave me that feeling of purpose and connection that I'd been lacking for a long time when I was in my drinking and my anxiety and all that. And so just knowing that was the feeling that I'd been missing and yearning for, I just sort of walked towards things that gave me that feeling. And every choice that I've made in my life in the last 7 years has been one based on that gut feeling of, does this feel fulfilling to me? Does it feel like it fills me up in some way and creates a sense of connection to something that's meaningful for me? And whatever industry you're in and whatever you're doing, if you're following that feeling, it's going to put you where you need to be. You know, you have options in terms of how to make a living. You have a lot of options of where to place yourself in the world. And, you know, amongst all those options, if you're doing something that essentially gives you no sense of contentedness in life, it just, you're just seeking, you know, success or whatever else might seem like it should give you a good life, then you're missing the essential ingredient of what, let's say, happiness really means. And, you know, again, happiness is fleeting. So we're really seeking that sense of fulfillment or contentedness that comes from being in flow and being connected to a process that essentially feels right.
Yeah. You know, you don't have to be an artist to be able to focus. Focus is part of flow, right? Focusing, keying in, focusing, challenging your skill set is part of flow, right? Like that's actually kind of the best part of flow is like you get to be a version of yourself you didn't even know was capable. Also, by the way, having goals, discipline to be able to clearly hit goals. You're talking about loss of self-consciousness, right? You're talking about like an awareness of something far greater than you. You say where I can just show up and have fun. But I do think that it's that positive mindset that's going to help you find that flow. Dude, thank you so much for sharing this. Do you still take on one-on-one clients? Is that something people would be able to check out on our website?
Yeah, well, thank you, Vinny. I am seeing clients one-on-one. I'm a therapist and a coach, and the best place to find me in terms of that is on my website, ryandutick.com. You can reach out to me there. And then it also as a speaker, you know, I'm doing a lot of speaking engagements, so that's a good way to find me. And then, you know, the other place to find the stuff that I've been doing is my Instagram handle at Ryan Michael Dusick. You know, just I post old stuff from the band. I post stuff that I'm doing now when I have appearances and other things that I'm doing. So that's kind of the more fun, interactive place.
What kind of services, what kind of conversations are you having with companies, corporations, businesses right now? One, that you're available for hire to do, but two, that you're actually having, because I think that these are important conversations. Creativity, mental health, neither of these topics ever get brought up. So any opportunity a company can open up and have this conversation, especially if they don't identify as a creative company, you know, especially if their output is not media, they have a very hard time approaching it. So what kind of conversations do you have there?
Well, it's been a really interesting time in my life in that, you know, putting out this book, Harder to Breathe, and promoting it, essentially, I was looking at it as just a way to inspire hope and to talk about my mental health as a way of connecting to people, to be of service. But what came from it, you know, in promoting and talking about it, doing a lot of interviews and going out into the world, doing some speaking engagements, I've had people from the music industry reaching out to me and asking, you know, if I want to work directly with people in the music industry again. So I've joined something called the Music Industry Therapist Collective, a bunch of therapists who had worked in the music industry previously and are now mental health professionals. That has led to some more interesting things. I've been writing a column in Variety magazine about mental health and the entertainment industry. And then I've been doing speaking also, you know, in specifically mental health areas. But the crossover that's also interesting is that I've been getting a lot of calls from people in the corporate world, entrepreneurship, business, because I think there's a connection in terms of wellness and in terms of investing in yourself and self-care and all the things that go into building a brand as much as building a life. You know, so there's a connection there that's interesting to me. I hadn't foreseen some of those things, but I see the connection now. And it's as somebody who's been in different industries over the course of the last 20 some odd years and entering into new ones now, I'm enjoying the process of potentially working in different media and connecting with people in different industries. And it's starting to happen. So it's been a really, really interesting and inspiring new time in my life.
Cool. Well, with the explosion of audio, I can't imagine a better person, a better collaborator, a better consultant to work with than someone who's mastered the audio world and can bring that part into the conversation, into the communication, and really just make sure the message gets heard. Dude, I appreciate you so much. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you.
You've been listening to I Have a Podcast with Vinny Podestivo. If you like what you heard and you want to hear more, please find us at ihaveapodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you next week.